I dream and hope I can still have someday. Two things I know for sure. The preventable harm inflicted on me will medically make it harder than it already was for me to get pregnant again. The barbaric restrictions our lawmakers have passed are having real life implications on real people. I may have been one of the first who was affected by the overturning of Roe in Texas, but I'm certainly not the last. More people have been and will continue to be harmed until we do something about it. The people in the building behind me have the power to fix this, yet they've done nothing. In fact, they're currently trying to pass even more restrictive measures. So it's not just for me and for our Willow that I stand here before you today. It's for every pregnant person and for everyone who knows and loves a pregnant person. It is with and for all Texans who, like me, are scared and outraged at the thought of being pregnant in this state that I stand and fight. Thank you.
Amanda Zarowski, one of five women suing Texas after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancies posed serious risk to their health and were non-viable. Two doctors are also suing. The case was brought by the Center for Reproductive Rights. They held the news conference in Austin, Texas. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Next Monday on Playful Presence, you'll hear...
Oh, Harold, you're so romantic.
Did you not understand my entire work slave comment? I'm completely willing, based on the amount of money that you pay me, to do anything that you wish.
That's because I'm mumbling into my everything bagel. Stanley, why do you do that?
So tune in Monday night, 11 p.m., March 13th, for Playful Presence, a show about improv, mindfulness, and play on KBOO Portland Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns and makes sure activities are in alignment with our mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with station management and staff to identify funding priorities, as well as create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. For more information, please visit kboo.fm/development-hire-23 or visit our homepage. The deadline to apply is Thursday, March 15th.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. Up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the first of six mass outdoor encampments for homeless Portlanders will be located in Inner Southeast.
President Biden proposes a new federal budget.
And what one study shows about the value of treating your weekend like a vacation.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 10th, 2023. I'm Ashley Mackey.
And I'm Josh Salem. The first of six planned mass homeless encampments in Portland has been secured. The mass encampments are a plan of Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler as a part of the justification for a ban on camping on public property. Originally, six 500-person camps were planned, then six 250-person camps. The number is now 150, and the first site has been secured in inner southeast Portland. Portland will rely heavily on service providers to manage the camps. One of these is Urban Alchemy, which has quoted the city around $5 million a year to run these camps. Advocates have questioned why such a large sum shouldn't be spent on direct housing costs and supportive services, as opposed to mass encampments that have the potential to re-traumatize people. There's also concern that unhoused Portlanders won't want to stay in these camps, and the city has not made it clear if they will be forced to do so. Here's Mayor Ted Wheeler announcing the first campsite yesterday.
The temporary alternative shelter sites I announced last November are now in the implementation phase. These sites are part of a multi-pronged approach to phase out unsanctioned homeless camps throughout the city of Portland. This effort will better connect homeless Portlanders who've been camping on sidewalks, along roadways, and in public spaces to much-needed services in a safe and sanitary environment. These sites will complement the array of other shelter services available to homeless Portlanders. After analyzing numerous properties across the city of Portland, we've identified some locations that best fit the need for developing these sites, one of which will be likely located at 1490 Southeast Gideon Street in Central East Side, Portland. We have an agreement in principle. We do not have the signed lease as of today, but I am very confident we will do that soon. The lot is situated in the Central East Side between the Brooklyn and Hosford Abernathy neighborhoods. Initially, this site will have up to 100 tents that can hold up to 150 individuals. This location will help provide safe, designated camping locations for homeless Portlanders who then can access basic services like food, restrooms, showers, laundry, electricity, and storage facilities. The site is located next to numerous public transportation options, and it will provide a pet area as well as community spaces. Our service teams will provide additional trash receptacles with regular collection and hazardous waste removal in the site and within a 1,000-foot perimeter of the site. The site will have a perimeter fence and round-the-clock security managed by the service provider. These sites will have rules. There will be no unsanctioned camping within 1,000 feet of this site. There will be no cooking or fires allowed. Alcohol and drug use will not be allowed in common areas or public spaces. These sites will have security. Weapons will be checked at the entrance. The service provider will patrol a 1,000-foot perimeter surrounding the site 16 hours a day, every day. After conducting a comprehensive search and completing a competitive bidding process, we've selected a qualified service provider with experience managing outdoor shelters. Urban Alchemy is a California-based nonprofit that is the best fit to manage Portland's temporary alternative shelter sites. Urban Alchemy already runs numerous sites in California and a congregate homeless shelter in the state of Texas. Urban Alchemy will likely run more than one shelter site here in the city of Portland, and their headquarters will be based at the Southeast Gideon Street location that I've announced today, for which they are the assigned service provider. I'm grateful that Urban Alchemy is partnering with us on this vital project. I'm confident that this is the right team for the city of Portland.
That was Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler speaking yesterday about the first site of six mass outdoor encampments the city has planned for the houseless population.
A new documentary, Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, looks at how the nuclear industry is promoting new technology. It also examines the campaign in Oregon resulting in the Trojan nuclear plant shutdown in 1992. Eric Tegedoff has more.
A film premiering this week tackles the potential harms of the nuclear industry. Portland State University Professor Emeritus Jan Hawken directed the documentary Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance. The film draws on historical lessons from the campaign to shut down the Trojan nuclear plant in Rainier, Oregon. The plant closed in 1992. Hawken says the nuclear industry is promoting a new design concept known as small modular reactors, or SMRs. Her initial interest in SMRs was about how the industry would handle waste.
Many of us were very attuned to the fossil fuel problem, but not so much nuclear that had kind of repackaged itself as clean, cheap, and promising.
Hawken says her film also focuses on areas beyond waste, such as claims the new technology is safer even as the industry pushes to streamline the regulatory process, its financial viability, and risk of proliferation. The film premieres Sunday in Portland and also includes a speakers panel. Head of Columbia Riverkeeper Lauren Goldberg says the nuclear industry has positioned the sector as a solution to climate change, but she notes experts aren't convinced the technology can be deployed fast enough to combat the crisis. Goldberg says the industry has its eye on the Northwest, although a proposal for SMR technology at the Hanford nuclear site in Washington was withdrawn last week.
For example, in the case of the proposed SMR at Hanford, the waste would have just sat along the Columbia for an unspecified amount of time, potentially hundreds of years or more. That's been what's happened with other now defunct nuclear facilities.
Hawken says nuclear technology that has not been completely fleshed out is not a good bet for the country's energy future.
I would put my money on renewables and engineers that are trying to figure out the grid problem and ways of developing conservation, rethinking our approach to energy with the technologies we have.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon lawmakers are considering a bill that would help students with disabilities get proper public education. Bill 819 would change the abbreviated school day program requirements in Oregon's public schools. The abbreviated day program has impacted hundreds of students with disabilities who have been unlawfully sent home early or for extended periods of time without due process. Bill 819 will require that parents or foster advocates must give informed and written consent, and schools must provide documentation for modifying a student's schedule. But the passage of this bill into law remains far from certain. Owen Bastable reports.
Good afternoon, everyone.
On February 7th, Senate Bill 819 was discussed in an education committee hearing chaired by State Senator Michael Dembro. The bill was sponsored by Democratic Senator Sarah Gelzer Bluen and proposes to make significant changes to Oregon's abbreviated day program. The abbreviated day program went into effect in 2017 for students with disabilities in Oregon schools. The program allows for shortening a student's day for an extended period of time. But since this program started, Tom Stenson, Deputy Legal Director for Disability Rights Oregon, has found that many schools are not using the abbreviated day program as it was intended.
It's been extensively documented and you know, very clearly stated that there's a massive problem of kids being on shortened school days completely inappropriate.
During the Education Committee hearing, several parents of Oregon students provided public testimony of their personal experiences with the abbreviated day program. Emily Perkel spoke about her experiences with her son.
Our very bright, curious, and kind 9-year-old autistic child has been struggling in our local school district since kindergarten. From the beginning, I was consistently asked to come to the school to help support him, essentially becoming his unpaid one-to-one adult support. We then put him on an abbreviated school day for the latter part of kindergarten.
Over the next few years, Emily's son continued to struggle. He was moved in and out of two specialized classrooms. By third grade, Emily reported the school started to use restraints to manage her son's behaviors.
During this time, we did not receive any official documentation related to these restraints. We did get the occasional phone call or email indicating the teacher had to hold him a few times or put him in the peace room. This is what they call the de-escalation or isolation room.
This January, just 2 weeks before she shared her story with the Oregon Education Committee, Emily decided to withdraw her son from school and homeschool him. This also resulted in her having to leave her job as a special education teacher in a school district.
We agreed to the placement only because we thought we could get more support. In a small light at the end of this dark tunnel, he finally started home instruction 2 weeks ago, and it's been a very positive experience. It's only 5 hours a week, but we'll take it. He can learn in a setting where he feels safe while we wait to find out what happens next.
As it turns out, Emily's son's story is not uncommon in Oregon schools, with at least 1,000 documented cases where students have been blocked from obtaining the education they are guaranteed under law. It is also not a new issue, with a pending lawsuit and over 10 years of concerns shared by parents and advocates seeking to address and modify the use of this practice in schools. Here's State Senator Sarah Gelzer-Bluen, who is the lead sponsor of Senate Bill 819.
So Senate Bill 819 is a long time coming. It's an issue that I have been working on for more than a decade. I actually found an email when I was cleaning out my email box the other day from 14 years ago.
State Senator Gelzer-Bluen started to notice a pattern of schools sending students home for unclear reasons, which she referred to as informal removals.
I started to hear from advocates about what at the time was called informal removals. And these were kids who were not suspended or expelled from school, but they were just kind of gently sent home or told not to come back, or they would, parents would be called to pick them up early or bring them late, or, you know, just come a couple of days a week.
With limited information or data on this practice, Senator Gelzer-Bluen reached out to other senators, and it took until 2017 for the legislature to pass the current abbreviated day program legislation.
And basically, we passed a bill that said you can't, a district cannot unilaterally place a student on an abbreviated school day. And unilaterally means without the consent of a parent. That is in the bill. That if you do it, it has to go through a formal process. You have to report it as a placement so that we can keep track of where this is happening.
Tom Stenson, Deputy Legal Director for Disability Rights Oregon, is concerned that the current legislation is not doing enough. And the problem is actually getting worse.
Unfortunately, it got cut back pretty heavily. A lot of the protections, some of which are in the new bill in SB 819, some of those provisions are back because we saw that, especially with a Department of Education that really didn't want to enforce it, things actually got worse after SB 263 was passed.
Senator Gelzer-Bluen also pointed out that for children on abbreviated days, it can be very difficult for parents to overturn the school's decision without significant legal and financial resources.
The idea of due process for families is very difficult to access. There are so many steps. It's incredibly complicated. The parent has the burden of proof to demonstrate that a free and appropriate public education has not been provided. But the district has publicly funded attorneys that fight families who are just trying to get things like reading instruction for their children. And they have all the records. So the deck is really stacked against students.
Although Bill 819 passed the Oregon Senate last week with unanimous bipartisan support, Senator Gelzer-Bluen is now concerned about the passage of this bill through the Oregon House, where it needs to go next before it can be signed into law by Governor Kotek.
We have gotten through step one in the Senate, but we have a long way to go. And the only way that we get it done is if the voices of these students and these families are louder and clearer than the education establishment. Because the education establishment is going to confuse people. They are going to make it seem like it's rare, that it's necessary, that these kids are scary. And that is simply not the case. These are not disciplinary removals. These are kids whose constitutional rights have been stripped from them when the school doors have been slammed in their faces. And that is simply not acceptable.
Bill 819 was introduced to the Oregon House and is expected to be voted on this month. For KBOO News, this is Owen Bastable reporting.
President Biden proposes a new federal budget. Norfolk Southern CEO testifies before Congress, and the House holds a hearing on the First Amendment implications of the handling of the Twitter files. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
So I want to make it clear, I'm ready to meet with the Speaker
anytime, tomorrow, if he has his budget. Lay it down. Tell me what you want to do. I'll show you what I want to do. See what we can agree on. If we don't agree on, let's see what we vote on.
President Joe Biden announced a $6.8 trillion budget, including increased spending on the military and a wide array of social programs, which he says will reduce future budget deficits and keep the burden off working families. It calls for $5 trillion in tax increases on high earners and corporations to offset new spending on programs to help the middle class and the poor. Republicans are calling for scaled back spending in the fight over the debt ceiling. Norfolk Southern CEO Alan Shaw testified before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee about the February train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. Shaw apologized to the town's residents and said Norfolk Southern is committed to helping them however it can.
Senator, I'm committed to doing what's right. You know, we're going to be there today, tomorrow, a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I've told the community that. I've been there in person.
According to data from the Federal Railroad Administration, there were 1,164 derailments last year. EPA Regional Administrator Deborah Shore said last month the agency issued an administrative order to hold the company accountable for all EPA costs related to the cleanup and restoration. The GOP-controlled House passed the Protecting Free Speech from Government Interference Act on a party-line vote to prohibit federal employees from censoring speech while acting in an official capacity. New Mexico Democratic Representative Melanie Stansberry described the bill's language as bizarre Orwellian doublespeak, arguing it doesn't protect free speech, but limits it.
It imperils our democracy by handcuffing the ability of law enforcement, national security, and intelligence officials to provide factual, critical information to social media companies and the public.
Passage of this bill comes as the House Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government conducted a hearing on the Twitter files, which examined internal documents from Twitter about content moderation. Journalist Matt Taibbi and author Michael Schellenberger testified on the contents, and members of the subcommittee engaged in tense exchanges. Louisiana Republican Representative Mike Johnson said it should be a top issue across party lines and for Americans because of free speech implications.
It is a bedrock principle of our constitutional system that the government does not get to decide what speech is acceptable or true. Under the First Amendment, Americans have a right to speak freely, regardless of whether their speech upsets the preferred narrative.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy, with an overnight low of 35. Tomorrow's weather has a 40% chance of rain and a daytime high of 51 degrees. Today is Harriet Tubman Day. The day recognizes the significant work of the abolitionist and worker on the Underground Railroad. Tubman helped to free over 70 people, leading them to the Northern Free States and Canada. The quote of the day is from Tubman, who said, "I had reasoned this out in my mind. There was one of two things I had a right to, liberty or death. If I could not have one, I would have the other."
The U.S. Supreme Court could rule on the fate of the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, as soon as this spring. Native advocates are pushing states to codify their own protections for Native children in the event the law gets overturned. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering a challenge to the Indian Child Welfare Act. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Will Walkie reports, some states, including Wyoming, are preparing their own laws if the courts deem ICWA unconstitutional.
ICWA requires state courts to prioritize placing Native American children in foster or adoption care within their tribal communities. It was passed in 1978 in response to the large number of indigenous children who were being separated from their cultural affiliations. Those against ICWA say it's unfair discrimination against non-indigenous people, but others, like Wyoming State Representative Landon Brown, disagree. He testified at the legislature in early March.
I want to make sure that we step back just for a half a second and realize that these are sovereign tribes. This isn't necessarily about the race issue. This is about granting those rights to the sovereign tribes.
The Wyoming legislature recently voted to codify ICWA protections for Native families. The state's governor signed that bill into law this week. Utah and Montana lawmakers have pushed to do the same. At least 11 other states, including New Mexico, have already done so. The court could make a ruling on ICWA as early as this spring. For National Native News, I'm Will Waukee in Laramie.
The nation's fentanyl crisis is hitting American Indian and Alaska Native communities harder than others. That's according to federal officials. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington on efforts to stem the tragic tide of overdoses in Indian country.
American Indian and Alaska Natives saw a 39% spike in overdoses between 2019 and 2020, according to the CDC. That's because of the flood of fentanyl pouring into America. Things only got worse during COVID lockdowns, as tribal leaders from coast to coast know all too well.
It's everywhere.
That's Mark Macaro, tribal chair of Southern California's Pechanga Band of Indians. Overdose rates among American Indian and Alaska Native women between 25 and 44 were nearly two times that of white women of the same age, according to the CDC. Macaro says it's a travesty.
What we see is fentanyl being put into other products that are unwittingly being used, or unwittingly causing death, and it's insidious. It's sickening that kind of sociopathic activities are being used there, and people are making money off of it. Cartels and others.
Native Americans and Alaska Natives have historically suffered higher rates of substance use disorder than their non-Native peers. But Macaro says fentanyl has made everything worse.
It makes everything more acute because maybe folks weren't going to die from casual recreational use of whatever the substance was, but death is near certain when it comes to fentanyl. And so it is more dangerous. It's gone to the next level.
The National Congress of American Indians continues lobbying Congress for more resources to fight the overdose epidemic. But with Republicans now in control of the House of Representatives, steep budget cuts may be on the horizon. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
This week, the U.S. Senate confirmed Patrice Kunish as the commissioner of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Native Americans, promoting tribal self-sufficiency and cultural preservation. The commissioner is one of the most senior Senate-confirmed federal officials in Native policy at HHS. The commissioner advises the health secretary on Indian affairs. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Those who lost family to COVID in Massachusetts are pressing lawmakers to make the first Monday in March COVID Remembrance Day. It would memorialize those lost to the virus and those who continue to suffer from long COVID. Catherine Carley speaks with the organizer of the effort.
Family members of those lost to COVID are urging lawmakers to pass legislation to formally recognize the first Monday in March as COVID Remembrance Day. The bill would make Massachusetts the 11th state to memorialize those who have died from the virus, as well as recognize those who suffer from long COVID and the essential workers who have been there through it all. Jennifer Ritz Sullivan of the nonprofit Marked by COVID says it's important to identify the nation's collective trauma.
It's a simple piece of legislation, but it is so powerful, and history needs to be recorded correctly, and our losses need to be remembered.
More than 1 million Americans have died of COVID, including nearly 24,000 Massachusetts residents. The federal government has announced it will end the national emergency and public health emergency declarations related to the COVID-19 pandemic on May 11th. But for bereaved activists like Ritz Sullivan, who lost her mother to the virus, the pandemic is not over. Too many people, she says, have suffered in isolated grief, and a formal recognition of that pain would help in both recovery and prevention.
We can't prevent what we're unwilling to acknowledge. So we're going to continue to see mass death and disability the more we turn away from this.
The Massachusetts bill to establish a COVID-19 Remembrance Day is based on federal legislation introduced by Senators Elizabeth Warren and Edward Markey, both Massachusetts Democrats. Efforts are underway to create a physical monument in Washington, D.C. to commemorate the pandemic's lasting impact. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
Weekends might mean a break from work, but many Americans spend one or both days running errands or packing in events that leave them exhausted by the following Monday. Researchers say for greater happiness, people should treat weekends like a vacation. Roz Brown spoke with one of the co-authors of the study to learn more.
If weekends fail to reduce your stress levels or bring you happiness, behavioral scientists say you should instead think of them more like a vacation. Researchers at the UCLA Anderson School of Management studied whether people who spent more money eating out at restaurants or hitting the ski slopes were happier than those who prioritized weekend relaxation. Study co-author Colin West says the research showed happiness wasn't based on activities.
What we found was that had little correlation with how happy people were on Monday. But what did predict how happy people were on Monday were people who treated it like a vacation. It didn't matter so much what they did, but they tended to be a little bit more in the present moment.
West says adopting a vacation mindset heading into the weekend could be compared to the Buddhist philosophy of mindfulness, which studies show can reduce stress levels and possibly make you happier. Americans get fewer vacation days than many people in other parts of the world, but some don't use the vacation days they're owed. Still others tie their personal value to productivity and treat weekends like any other day. West argues a reset can help avoid the Monday blues many people report at the beginning of a new work week.
Sometimes there's a bit of a status to, oh, I'm so busy right now, that people kind of almost brag about how busy they are. And prioritizing leisure time can seem frivolous. And if you don't mentally prioritize it, then you're not going to get the benefits of it.
Of course, chores, such as cleaning house or grocery shopping, don't magically disappear when you treat the weekend like a vacation. But West says many in the study noted improved well-being when they tweaked their approach.
They reported, actually, when I was doing chores around the house, I really tried to like be in the moment and not be thinking about work or stressing about things. I tried to get that